From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Hillary Rodham Clinton cruised to a landslide victory yesterday in the West Virginia primary. She crossed Senator Obama by taking 67% of the vote, but is her win too little too late? The Clinton campaign says West Virginia shows she can win in the key swing states and Obama cannot. NPR senior editor Ron Elving gives us the inside scoop. Hey, Ron.
Hey, Farai. Good to be with you.
Yes, always good to have you. And so with another primary behind us, are people jumping the gun when they say Obama is going to be the nominee?
I don't believe people are jumping the gun because people are looking at the numbers, the arithmetic, the mathematics. Where people would be jumping the gun, however, would be in saying that there is absolutely no way that this thing could still turn around. There is a way that it could still turn around if the superdelegates decided that they wanted to overrule the pledged delegates. And as we've been saying, of course, for many months now, the pledged delegates are those people whose votes reflect the actual results in the caucuses and primaries, and they are the dominant delegate type. But then there are about 800 people who get to go to the convention, 800 out of 4,500 voting delegates, and they get to go because they're members of the National Democratic Committee or because they are elected office holders who are Democrats, mostly members of Congress. Now, these people can exercise their independent judgment, and if they wish to do so, they can overturn the result among the pledged delegates. So the pledged delegate count is pretty much set. We know where that's going to wind up. Barack Obama is going to be something like 140 or 150 ahead. Not a huge margin, but certainly a substantial one. And the superdelegates are going to have to decide which way they want to go. But as you know, over the past week, Barack Obama has moved into the lead among the superdelegates. That's the direction their judgment is going. They are showing no inclination whatsoever to overrule the pledged delegates.
Now, an Associated Press exit poll showed 1 in 4 Clinton voters said that race was a factor in their vote. Now, we should also say that West Virginia is a state with only 5% black population. Also, a Washington Post article this week explored racial incidents that some Obama volunteers faced while campaigning. So race is part of the race. Can Obama overcome race if he's nominated?
I don't believe that Barack Obama is going to make America forget race. In November, people are going to be looking at an African-American candidate and a white American candidate, and that's going to be part of their perception. The question is, can he make other issues more important to people than the issue of race? And that has obviously been a great question, if not the great question, in American social history. So all of these other factors are going to come into play. Where the two candidates stand on the issues, which of these two people Americans can imagine in the White House and representing their views in the White House, who they want to have be representing America around the world. All of these different things that always come into play in a presidential election will come into play again, and then we'll have to weigh them against the longstanding American preoccupation with race.
So how many contests do we have left?
Not too many. Next Tuesday, we have Kentucky and Oregon. That will probably be one for each candidate. Then on June the 1st, we have a primary in Puerto Rico, which doesn't vote in the presidential election in November, but does send delegates to the convention. And then on June 3rd, we have Montana and South Dakota. And Farai, that's it.
Well, you know, when the Democrats go to Kentucky and Oregon, Obama didn't actually campaign in those states. He went to Missouri instead. So what was the reasoning behind that?
The Obama campaign feels that it's time to start looking at the performance of their candidate against John McCain in the fall, not only because that's what matters ultimately the most, but because what happens between now and some of these other events I just described is not going to make a great deal of difference. We assume that that Hillary Clinton will pick up some more delegates by winning Kentucky and Puerto Rico. The other three events look likely to go to Obama. It's probably going to be pretty close to a wash, maybe a few more delegates for her. That's not the issue anymore. The issue now is persuading superdelegates, and that's done largely through the media. And so Barack Obama is going out to the swing states for the fall election and campaigning against John McCain and sending a message to the superdelegates that he's ready for that matchup.
We know that Senator Clinton has a large campaign debt, some reports say $20 million. Does Senator Obama still have a war chest to use for things like television ads?
Yes, Obama essentially has as much money as he needs. And this has been a tremendous, tremendous strength of his campaign throughout, that whenever money was the question, whenever money was the issue, he could supply the money through his extraordinary fundraising largely on the internet. It's not just that people have given him money, it's that so many more people have given him money than any other politician in American history. It used to be a big deal to get 100,000, 200,000 donors to your campaign. Now, of course, several candidacies have pushed well beyond those numbers. Certainly Hillary Clinton has. But Barack Obama blew right straight through 500,000, 1 million. He's now approaching 1.5 million donors. And of course, they are not all giving the maximum amount of money. Most of them are just giving $100 or less or $200 or less. Nonetheless, the size, the base of that fundraising operation means that he can raise all the money that he needs, including, very possibly, money that would go to help retire Hillary Clinton's campaign debt after she does drop out, assuming someday she does.
Well, Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Farai.
That was NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, and he joined me at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And now we're going to continue to talk about the White House race and more with our own political gurus. Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert George is an associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Hi, folks.
Hello, hey, Farai.
So we just heard Ron Elving parse out the numbers, and it seems like an uphill battle at best for Hillary Clinton. But she did win 67% of the West Virginia vote, and she's urging Democratic leaders to take a hard look at the victory. Robert, more superdelegates are in Obama's camp now than Clinton's. But should they take a second look at the state of the race because of West Virginia?
I think they should. Because notwithstanding the superdelegates trickling over to Obama right now, because what's going to end up happening next week is that Hillary Clinton will do very, very well in Kentucky. It may not be the 40-point blowout that she got in West Virginia. Obama will do well in Oregon and will win Oregon. But my feeling is that her percentage win in Kentucky is going to be larger than his percentage win in Oregon. And it's very, very clear Hillary is not going to get out before June. And by the end of the primary process, she may very well have a slight edge in popular votes. And I think she's going to take that with her to the convention.
Mary, do you agree that she might get the edge in the popular vote, first of all? And secondly, I mean, is it a situation where the Democratic Party is going to have to work extra hard to get white working class voters, no matter who the nominee is?
I think, first of all, it's too soon to call the election. I think Obama is being premature. I had a chat yesterday with two superdelegates who haven't endorsed anybody yet. And they said they're going to wait to see if Hillary Clinton wins the popular vote, and that if she does win the popular vote, even if it's by one, they're going to say, because they remember Al Gore getting the popular vote and not getting the, you know, electoral votes, that they may change, you know, they may go with her. So I don't know if that's true. The crucial time is today and the next few days when we see whether Clinton can, in fact, get the superdelegates to still hold off. There's been a trickle toward Obama, but there hasn't been, you know, a stream of people. So if he can do that, then it's over. But if he can't, then we have to wait. And I expect her to get a lot of popular votes out of Puerto Rico, which Obama seems to be ignoring. The odds are still that he'll be the candidate, but we can't really tell that. As far as West Virginia, the most interesting thing about it was not the rural blue-collar vote, which she got, but the fact that she took the under 30 vote, and she also took the more affluent vote, white vote. They all voted for her, which is interesting because we always expect Obama to take the affluence and the under 30s, and he didn't there.
He may have made a strategic error similar to the one that she made earlier on when she was, in a sense, skipping a lot of these caucuses. I think had he actually gone into West Virginia and made a play specifically for his base vote, those, as you said, the under 30s and the above college graduate type, he could have made it a little bit closer. I mean, she ended up getting a net of, I believe, about 140,000 votes out of that. He could have made that a lot narrower, and that may come back to haunt him.
And so giving the back of his hand, as it were, to the West Virginia voters and telling them that they're not that important, and doing the same thing to the Kentucky voters, I don't think is a good strategy. It's just like, as Robert said, Clinton ignored the caucus states. It's not over until the fat lady sings, and the fat lady hasn't sung yet. And so he can wait. People forget also, and I'm amazed at the lack of historical memory among some of Obama's supporters. Senator Ted Kennedy, I was with him in 1980 when he went all the way to the convention, and he didn't have nearly as many delegates as Clinton has, made that great speech at the convention and all the rest. I'll never forget it. And now he and others who are supporting seem to think the thing is over before it's really over. There is something about if you tell people something is over, maybe they'll believe you. And then perception becomes reality, and then you can move on.
Well, it's like Animal House, you know. It's not over until we say it's over, you know. Right. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? That's a line from the movie. I
right.
know about that.
You know exactly.
Yeah, but it was exactly. Animal House. And, you know, and there was a whole Monty Python sketch quoted in the Washington Post today about the dead parrot. I won't go into the whole thing. But you know, the media... you know, we in the media often seem to be saying it is over. Robert, you got 20 seconds to tell me, is the media culpable for jumping the gun?
Of course the media is culpable for jumping the gun. I mean, the media has been ending this race going back to freaking New Hampshire. I mean, it's you think the collective we would have learned a lesson by now. Obama is the leader in the delegates. He will not have the clinching delegates by June 3rd. Neither will Hillary Clinton. So all everything right. else is just up for discussion.
This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are back talking all things politics with Associate Editorial Page Editor for the New York Post, Robert George, and Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, Mary Frances Berry. I'm going to go straight into this. We're talking about Senators Obama and Clinton, and I want to play a clip from Hillary Clinton's victory speech last night.
I am more determined than ever to carry on this campaign. Until everyone has had a chance to make their voices heard.
Now, this seems to be in reference to the Florida and Michigan delegates that Clinton has been fighting hard to seat. And at the end of the month, on May 31st, a DNC Rules Committee says it's going to decide what to do with the disputed primaries in Florida and Michigan. Obama's actually in Michigan right now campaigning. So, Mary, first, what do you think these candidates want for those delegates in the states that sort of jumped ahead and were unseated effectively?
Well, my own view, which Roger Wilkinson expressed to Howard Dean weeks ago about Florida and Michigan and warned him to solve it. And at that time he said, oh, well, we'll wait till the convention. See, he's changed his mind. Anyway, my own view is that Florida, where everybody was on the ballot and the results came out, and I've been down to Florida several times, and people down there feel strongly about it, that it ought to be settled. Their superdelegates ought to be seated. Their delegates ought to be seated. But they're willing to have some diminution of the numbers, and I think that should be a sort of no-brainer, and let's get it over with. Florida has been disenfranchised too much. Let's not have that again. As far as Michigan, it's harder. But in Michigan, I think that if Obama thinks he's going to get anywhere there, that he needs to resolve this too. For too long, he acted as if he didn't care whether Michigan voted or not. And so I think that'll be harder. They'll probably split it down the middle and go forward from there. But Florida, I think that she had a clear advantage. They were all on the ballot, and that's what they should do, even if they reduce the number of votes. And I'm happy that they plan to solve it before they go to the convention, or at least try to solve it at this Rules Committee meeting.
Robert, Senator Clinton also made some early remarks that, you know, Michigan basically needed to pay for its actions, or it wasn't critical to seat these folks. Both candidates now definitely are saying that it's critical to give people some kind of representation. But what is the question? And, you know, Obama wasn't even on the slate in Michigan. Michigan specifically, what do you think should happen?
Well, yeah, exactly. Though it's very interesting to hear the Clintons say, well, you know, we decided we didn't take our name off the ballot. You know, it was Obama and Edwards chose to have their names taken off. You know, we shouldn't be punished for that, which is rather interesting. Gamesmanship. Mary Frances is right, however, that it's a little bit more clearer in the context of Florida, and that they're both, that they were all on the ballot, though it Hillary Clinton at that time had a built-in advantage because of name recognition. The Republicans had it right, and I'm not just saying this because the party, both the Republicans in Florida and Michigan, did the same thing. They moved up their numbers, and what the RNC did was they took away half of the delegate slate, and they allowed the process to go on, and everybody voted, and instead, Michigan and Florida got less delegates awarded because they decided to break the rules. The Democrats, unfortunately, decided to take away all of the delegates, which is why they're in this process right now. My observation would be, it makes the most sense, take away half the delegates of Florida and seat the rest to the proportion of what they got on the ballot, and then do like a 50-50 split between, or maybe a 55-45 split between Clinton and Obama for Michigan. But
Robert. But the superdelegates ought to be seated in both places. Yes, that's part of this process.
That's correct.
Keep in mind that the people, they remind me of this every time I go to Michigan or Florida, the people didn't do this. Right. It was the Republican legislature that made them do it, and the officials do it in Florida. And in Michigan, it was the leaders who did it. The ordinary Joe and Mary who went out and voted, they were trying to vote.
The ordinary Robert and Mary.
They shouldn't be Robert and Mary. They shouldn't be penalized because of some idiocy on the part of their leaders.
And that is why also when we're factoring in the popular vote, because this is going to become a part of the discussion, the Florida popular vote should certainly count since everybody was on the ballot.
Absolutely.
And the Michigan one is open to dispute.
All right, I got a couple more topics I want to touch on. One of them is the Federal Election Commission, or FEC. It has 6 spots. Only 2 are filled. 4 have been vacant for a while. The president recently announced some new nominees, but his choice has also caused controversy. Robert, this is the body that's supposed to be watchdog over campaign finance and all that. So why are there only 2 members on the commission?
Well, the actual explanation for this would take about twice as long as we have here today. Very, very quickly, though, this is a situation that often happens when you have a divided government, because the FEC is the only one of the major commissions where you've got an equal number of Republicans and Democrats, because they need to keep everything as the perception of fairness as possible. Various members' terms were up, and you've got a Republican president who wants to appoint his new members. You Democrats who want to appoint theirs. Neither of them can agree as to who these people should be, and each of them are raising various objections. So as a result, you've only got 2, and there are a number of outstanding questions, not the least of which involve John McCain's opting in and then opting out of the campaign finance system. Ironically enough.
Well, at best, Farai, the FEC, even in the best of times, is sort of a toothless tiger because it never really makes anybody do anything, and it acts so slowly, and it's balanced. But what's sticking in the craw of the Democrats in the Senate is one of the members who's been nominated, who, in fact, was at the Justice Department, and who they felt was unfair to minorities on voting rights because he was in favor of a strong ID provision for fraud. Yes. And some people say, well, he's vindicated because the Supreme Court just upheld that. But the Democrats don't agree that there should be such a provision. And we just saw in Indiana with the nuns who couldn't vote what happens with ID provisions. So they still aren't happy. And Mr. Bush nominated some new people. And a couple of them seem to be, nicely balanced. But he still keeps this guy's name up there. And that's sticking in the craw of the Democrats. And that's why this has dragged on so long. And we'll have to see how that turns out.
Well, as we say, there should be strong ID, but you shouldn't bar none.
Right.
Oh, you are, You are the king of puns. You are the king of puns. All right, I'm going to move on. I want to talk about the housing bill. Last week, the House signed a housing bill. President Bush promised to veto it. Yesterday, Senator Dodd revealed his own housing bill in the Senate to help troubled homeowners. So, Robert, what's Dodd proposing that's different from the bill last week in the House?
Dodd wants to, for one thing, give broader regulation to the regulatory bodies. It's weird. You want to regulate the regulators even more. FHA. And there's a dispute as to how much forgiveness there should be on a lot of these loans, and therefore how much the federal government should back newer loans at more favorable terms than many of these subprime loans. The problem is the House one, even though you got 40 Republicans to go along with it, the president, as you said, has already threatened to veto that one, and the ranking Republican on Dodd's committee, Dick Shelby, feels that there's just too much government involved in Dodd's bill, and you need 60 votes to get a bill out of the Senate, and what Dodd is proposing is not going to get that out of there.
The sticking point in this whole thing is the Democrats want to have some relief for low-income people who have been foreclosed so they can go back and have their mortgages taken up, refinanced. And the Republicans are saying that these folks, many of them made bad decisions. They shouldn't have gotten these houses in the first place. And you shouldn't be bailing them out because they're responsible taxpayers who are, in fact, paying their mortgages and that they shouldn't be helped. Democrats are saying, we already bailed out the banks and all these funds and everything else. What's wrong with bailing out these people? And Chris Dodd was snookered by the Secretary of the Treasury, who led him to believe that they were working together on this, and then they pulled the rug out from under him. So that's what the issue is. Are you going to drop any kind of provisions for the people who have been foreclosed, who are these really, and a disproportionate number of those people, by the way, were black folks. A lot of them working mothers who had bought houses for the first time and who were harmed by this whole subprime mortgage crisis.
All right, we're now on to speed round, and it's an international speed round. This is Russia. You know, former president, current prime minister Vladimir Putin had some harsh words for the U.S. yesterday. He called the U.S. a hungry wolf that, quote, eats and listens to no one. So, Robert, speed round, what's going on with U.S. and Russia, and could it hurt the U.S.?
Certainly. I mean, first of all, Putin has been ramping up the rhetoric against the U.S. For at least a year and a half now. He wants to see Russia in, if not as a superpower, but as a power that cannot be ignored. And given that, and given their oil reserves and things like that, they definitely pose a long-term problem for the U.S.
The principal issues are the European ballistic missile shield that we want to put, the United States wants to put in Eastern Europe, and the Russians are absolutely opposed to that. They see it as a threat to them. They see us meddling in, as they say, affairs in Eastern Europe and various places and in what used to be the Soviet Union and those republics. They don't like that. They basically think that the United States doesn't respect them as Russia's back, they keep saying, and Russian nationalism is back and that we don't respect it. And they don't like the Eastern European countries flowing into NATO. They feel that that's threatened to them. And so I think that Medvedev, who's the new president, is going to carry on the same attitude that Putin had, because it's favored by the public in Russia. And they also have a bad feeling about capitalism as such without it being regulated, because right after the fall of the Soviet Union, all this corruption took place with all of these people buying up the businesses, the state-owned businesses, and the new Russian mafia coming in. So they all have a bad taste in their mouth about the United States, and they want to flex their muscles, as Robert said, and they have some specific issues that are going to have to be resolved.
And the thing is, though, Putin basically, larded up his parliament with a bunch more loyalists. So he's going to be ruling from the Duma, even though Medvedev obviously is a loyalist to him as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Robert and Mary, great talking to you as always.
Thank you for the opportunity, as always.
Appreciate it.
Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. She joined me at NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C., and Robert George is an associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, and he spoke with us from our NPR studios in New York. A case of apparent police brutality in Philadelphia has caused an uproar in the city, and it's also the hottest topic on our blog News and Views. News and Notes web producer Jeffrey Bennett is here to tell us what you have been saying online. So, hey, Jeff.
Hey there, Farai.
So there's a video showing half a dozen Philadelphia police officers kicking and beating three men pulled from a car during a traffic stop. We posted the footage on our blog and got plenty of people talking. What's the verdict, Jeff?
So, yeah, reaction ranged from that of outrage over the apparent police brutality to those who defended the police and blamed the suspects. Now, we got over 10 times the usual response on this topic alone, mostly because our coverage was posted to the front page of dig.com, which is a social networking site where people share links and talk about current events. But on our blog, Will Nett, who's one of our readers, wrote, "As a former police officer of 10 years, this is pretty bad. I'm quite sure the suspects all now have excellent pro bono lawyers, and the department is going to have a smaller budget next year after the lawsuits." Mike G wrote, "Three officers have already been killed in Philly in the past 2 years. I don't think police officers should operate beyond the letter of the law, but I do think a message needs to be sent to criminals in our cities." And Derek, another reader, wrote, "Exercising restraint in tense situations and using good judgment is part of a police officer's basic job description. They choose to be cops, and if they can't do their job correctly, then they should be fired, period."
Now, we've got another big topic this week. It's politics, specifically whether Barack Obama should help bail Hillary Clinton out from her $20 million campaign debt. You posted some interesting material, and folks had some things to say. What's going on?
Well, on our blog, at least, we're hearing emphatic cries of no. No written in all caps, no with a bunch of extra O's, no with exclamation points. It's worth pointing out that even if Obama were to help Clinton pay some of her campaign debt, federal election law wouldn't allow him to pay them off directly. He'd have to call for his supporters to chip in or hold a joint fundraiser. But that doesn't seem to matter much to our readers. Moji Odorinde wrote, "Should Obama help Clinton? In the famous words of Whitney Houston, hail to the gnaw." Valerie wrote, "Senator Clinton needs to deal with the consequences of her poorly run, poorly funded, and unsuccessful campaign." And CC wrote, "No, no, 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 no. That would be like chivalry gone wrong." So tell us how you really feel, people.
Exactly. So also on Monday's Bloggers Roundtable, we focused on R. Kelly standing trial on child pornography charges. This is 6 years after the initial charges were filed. So what was the say on our blog?
Well, we're talking about the public's acceptance of entertainers with rap sheets. Now, one can make the argument that R. Kelly's career hasn't suffered much, even though he's facing these child pornography charges. And then there's an artist who, like Akon, who, according to thesmokinggun.com, exaggerated his criminal past for the purposes of street cred and to further his career. So in response to that line of discussion, Bill M. wrote, "I'm a fan of R. Kelly's music. I don't really care what he does with his life. If moral purity were a requirement for good music, then we wouldn't have much to listen to." And Lolita Amos, she wrote in our blog, "The hip-hop generation doesn't seem to care much about character. What's worrisome isn't that Akon faked a record to get street cred. What's sad is that he felt he needed to."
Jeff, I'm also going to write up something on Nina Simone, who is one of my favorite artists, and we spoke to her daughter, aired that yesterday, so that's coming up, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He joined me from our studios at NPR West. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Al Sharpton's got problems with the tax man. Folks are fighting over the look and national origin of a memorial statue of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and a historically black college gets its first white valedictorian. With us today, Arlene Fenton from the blog Black Women Vote, Josen Cummings, he writes and edits the blog Speakeasy on Vibe magazine's website, and Dwayne Brayboy of Black Informant. Hi, guys.
Hey,
hi.
How you doing?
Thanks for having us.
So let's talk Sharpton. Reverend Al is fighting with the feds over alleged tax fraud again. According to records obtained by the Associated Press, Sharpton and his various businesses owe Uncle Sam close to $1.5 million in overdue taxes and penalties. He says it's a witch hunt of the kind civil rights figures expect from the government, and he also disputes the total amount of debt he owes. So let me start with you, Josen. Is Al Sharpton an innocent victim of IRS intimidation, as he wants us to believe?
I don't know if he's innocent or guilty yet, but I find it funny that, you know, when people of Al Sharpton's stature, when the IRS is going after them about their taxes, they want to call it a witch hunt. Either you paid your taxes or you didn't. And if you didn't pay them, then no, it's not a witch hunt. You should just pay them. It's similar to Wesley Snipes saying that they were out to get him. Everybody has to pay taxes. We all pay taxes every year. You know, the guy from the National Action Network, Executive Director Charles King, said that there's been some infrastructure problems and we couldn't really keep up. But you can't play around with the taxes. You can't play around with the IRS. So whatever, however much you're growing, however big your company is growing, just make sure that your taxes are right, because if not, they're going to come after you.
Arlene, following up on what Josen said, bloggers are saying a few things. One of them says he wants to raise taxes on the wealthy, but he's not paying his own. Typical. Another blogger writes, there's something hypocritical about using the noble fight for civil rights as a justification for the lack of honesty in business dealings. Those are both pretty harsh. Do you think they're deserved?
I'm not sure if they deserved, because I don't know if the tax issue was done on purpose or done through incompetence or if he's innocent. But I will say I come from a long line of pastors with churches, and when you're tax exempt and you're getting higher and higher levels of donations, you have to mind your P's and Q's. And, you know, I have very complicated feelings about Al Sharpton. I had a huge argument with him on his show the other day and had to deal with several people from his organization, and if they are indicative of the general level of competence, I think he's in big trouble. So I think, you know, he really needs to work on that immediately. I don't think necessarily that this is some kind of witch hunt.
Dwayne, you know, when you think about the history of the civil rights movement, there have been a lot of cases, most notably with Reverend King and the FBI, where there's been huge amounts of pressure, intimidation, COINTELPRO, all that. Regardless of what Reverend Al's actual tax situation is it worth bringing up the history between the government and the civil rights movement?
In this case, I would have to agree with the brother that first commented. I think that's a separate issue. Look, basically, if you owe taxes, you need to pay for it. You need to pay it. I'm not... You know, but I will say this. I haven't got my income tax return check, so I'm not trying to say too much right now. Let me wait until I get my check in and I can give you the real deal, okay? No, but seriously, you got to pay your taxes. Look, Wesley Snipes went all the way to Africa, out of all places, trying to escape from the IRS. He found himself a little hut and everything. Now, where is he now? Signing an autograph on a lunch tray belonging to a guy named Lil Hennessy. I mean, so he, you know, so you have to do it. I don't care who you are. You got to pay your taxes.
The other thing you have to realize is that Al Sharpton takes up these kinds of causes that that are basically, he goes head up against the government, goes head up against the police. He has a big mouth. And the fact of the matter is they're going to look for a way to take you down just because they're tired of you being out there. And if they can get you on taxes, they'll get you on taxes. So, you know, going back to what I think we've all said, just make sure your taxes are straight.
As my mom likes to say, wear clean underwear. You never know where you'll end up in the hospital. So moving on, there's more drama over a new Martin Luther King Jr. memorial. The Federal Arts Commission wants the statue of the slain civil rights leader reworked because it's too, quote, confrontational. It reminds some people of the stance and statues of dictators like Lenin and Saddam Hussein. Now, you can see a picture of the statue at our blog, News and Views. Make up your own mind. And Arlene, seeing the pictures, you know, in newspapers, on the web, do you think it captures the spirit of Dr. King?
Oh, my gosh. No, it doesn't even look like him. When I first saw the picture, I didn't even realize that was the one of Martin Luther King. He looked a lot like that comedian on Saturday Night Live. I don't know his name, but it did not look like Martin Luther King. And not only that, the stance that he had, I did not think was indicative of the essence of Martin Luther King at all. So I'm definitely in agreement with them sending that back and asking for a rework.
Dwayne, one blogger wrote, "How come Martin Luther King Jr. doesn't have a smile on his face and he's waving to the, not waving to the people who are walking by to see him? I think that would be better." Now, on the other hand, some people say, "Hey, he was an activist. He wasn't smiling all the time. Why does he have to smile?" So, what do you think about that? What would you, if you had to pose a multi-million dollar statue of Reverend King, what pose would you put him in?
I think if I whatever my suggestion is, believe you me, you're going to find probably 10,000 people that's going to say no. You know, they don't like that. So the good thing that happened in this in the beginning was that they had a panel that initially looked at this, and they, and most of them were black, and they agreed that the pose that he had, you know, that they used in this for this particular statue was A-okay. Everyone loved it. Now all of a sudden, you know, now all of a sudden people are not liking it because, you know, it reminds them of statues that you see in communist countries. And I think there's a lot more to the story. And I've commented on my site. I've actually discussed with the people with King's Azar. King is Ours. That's an organization that, and I don't want to get into all of that, but basically they feel that a black guy was that was originally slated to do the project was slighted and skipped over, and what they did was actually went with an Asian guy to do the project, and then there's been a lot of bad blood. Yes, and what happened was because they went with him, there's been a lot of bad blood that's been boiling in D.C. ever since then. So I think that may also have a part into this story here, but
well,
you
let
know,
me ask
you're
you
not
about
be able
that
to
directly.
Please anybody.
Do you think that the statue should have been carved by a U.S. sculptor, not by someone from another country, not in another country? It's being carved in China. And do you think that that's a problem?
Oh, I think. Oh, you're asking me?
Yep.
Oh, I'm saying, I think that's a serious problem. I agree with them. I think that, I mean, we have more than enough granite here, more than enough people here in this country that could have pulled off the job and have done it easily, you know. But the fact that they went with, you know, or having people in China do it, I mean, it says a lot about King, which he marched, you know, his whole life was about, was everything that China is for. It's actually against what China is for. And I just think that it's a contradiction there, even how they're even building it. I'm not so hung up with the how he looks. I mean, I think, quite frankly, I have no problem with him. I mean, how he's being portrayed. But I have more of a problem with, as you brought up, with the fact that it's being made in China. I really have a serious problem with that.
All right. Moving on, we want to talk about the valedictorian at Morehouse. The first white student has been chosen valedictorian at Atlanta's Morehouse College, and the historically black school happens to be the alma mater of Dr. King. Morehouse didn't even graduate a white student until 1966. And this year, 22-year-old Joshua Packwood of Kansas City, Missouri, is graduating with a perfect 4.0 GPA and a degree in economics. He says being surrounded by black men taught him more about diversity.
I saw that I could come here and ironically be accepted for who I am. And being the minority amongst minorities, quite honestly, everybody's been extremely accommodating and have taken me more so at face value as who I am. And of course, you know, there, you know, you can't really get outside of the issue of race here, and neither should you. It still is a major issue in America, and it's something that's addressed every day here on campus. But at the same time, I don't feel marginalized by it whatsoever. And it's an amazing balance that Morehouse has been able to provide for me.
Arlene, before I move on, I want to reintroduce our bloggers roundtable for folks who are just tuning in. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are talking with Arlene Fenton from the blog Black Women Vote, Josen Cummings of Speakeasy, a blog on Vibe magazine's website, and Dwayne Brayboy of Black Informant. Arlene, you're up at bat, and let me just mention this. Packwood was one of only a few white students at his high school in Missouri. He has mixed-race siblings. His mother was married to a black man. Do you think that this motivated him to go to Morehouse, and is there really a problem with him being the valedictorian?
Well, I'm going to give you the PC answer and then my honest answer. I think that there really shouldn't be an issue with his race necessarily. I did hear that he chose Morehouse because he was heavily recruited to go there, not necessarily for another reason that is more personal in nature. But I'll be honest, my gut reaction when I first read it, you know, I had a raised eyebrow and, you know, I kind of went into parental mode in terms of, you know, shame on you to the brothers in there, because I'm saying if you have a program that's geared to, you know, specifically for your needs, you know, how could you not capture the number one role? But it could be that he's some kind of phenom, and actually, you know, that's the way it played out this time. But it did raise some eyebrows on my side anyway.
Dwayne, what do you think?
I guess I have to totally disagree with that. I mean, mm-hmm. I thought it was, if anything, it was a testament of MLK's dream that, you know, that people would be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. I mean, here you have, I mean, almost 60 years old, 60 years to the day, you have a white man graduating from as a valedictorian from the same school that Martin Luther King graduated from 60 years ago. I mean, I think it's a major milestone for Black history in the country. And for those who are choosing, and for those who are choosing to be cynical over this, I mean, either are not trying to see or don't want to see the bigger picture here. I think it's a great accomplishment. I mean, and to go to her point, Arlene's point, I think that you have to look at all the other years. I mean, this is not the first year that Morehouse had a valedictorian graduate. I mean, all those other years, you've had plenty of Black men that have done that job. So, I mean, I think it's a great accomplishment, and I think it says a lot about how far we have come as a country on this particular issue.
How far we have come. Because what I'm saying is it depends on perspective and also the whole picture. Because I think, you know, it does say something when you have a program that is specifically, from what I understand, you can correct me if I'm wrong, there to help African-American men excel to their highest potential. So if we're going to have, you know, this kind of, you know, excelling of someone of another race, I think people are going to draw conclusions. And I want to know, is this really competitive, you know, on their side?
I went to Howard University. I didn't go to Morehouse. But my point is that the kind of education that you receive at a historically Black college is going to be tied into whatever you choose to major in. This guy, he majored in economics. That's not something that necessarily you can gear just towards Black men. So Black men that go to Morehouse aren't necessarily going to get an advantage over Josh or any other student of any other color.
Let me get Josen in here. I want you to keep it tight because I know that you have also been blogging about the Sean Bell issue. So, Josen, what do you think?
I mean, this is one of those things for anybody who's mad, any Morehouse student who's upset about it, which I haven't met that many that are, just do better in school. just do better. If we can't afford to make this an issue when right now there are people who aren't voting for Barack Obama simply because he's Black, want to shut him out of this process because he's Black. We can't be doing the same to white people and saying, no, you don't deserve to be a valedictorian because you are not like us. He went to the school. He did the work. He got the 4.0. If no one else got the 4.0, that's unfortunate, but hey. You know, just he deserves all the props that come with the work that he's accomplished.
And Josen,
I have to move on. Josen, just want to sneak this in because it's timely. You've been blogging about rappers doing tributes for Sean Bell. Police fired 50 shots at Bell outside a New York nightclub just hours before his wedding, killing him, and NYPD detectives were acquitted of all charges. Let's take a listen to Bronx rapper Mickey Facts. His song is called I'm Sean, and it's written from the perspective of Sean Bell from the moments before his death into the afterlife.
1 cap, 2 cap, 3 cap, 4, 48, 49, 50 shots more. White world, Black man, this is my song, my story, my life, my death, I'm Sean. Every police officer and official that lied on me and said that I was a threat, well, he died slowly. I'm just another Black man shot dead, cause the pig that was holding the gun was a hothead. And tell Rodney King I think we'll never get along, this bullseye's on minorities, this shit is wrong. Now I'm just another punchline in songs, and every Black leader now wanna get involved.
Now, Josen, Is this sort of lifting up this issue into the national consciousness? Why do you think folks very quickly are doing these kinds of tracks?
Because they realize that it can happen to them. And I remember the day that the verdict was read, and soon after, rappers were going in the studio and recording these songs, emailing us over at the Vibe offices saying, hey, we got this song. We'd love for you guys to post it up. So it's not for profit. They're not necessarily trying to capitalize off of this tragic event. They do it because they care. They hit the studio. They pay for that studio time. They go in there.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. But I know that on your blog, you have a lot more about it. And
yes,
we will definitely link to it and check it out. So Arlene, Josen, and Dwayne, thanks so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Arlene Fenton from the blog Black Women Vote. She was at the Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. Josen Cummings, who writes the blog Speakeasy on Vibe Magazine's website, he's blogging about this Sean Bell music issue. He was at our New York studios. And Dwayne Brayboy of the blog Black Informant at KUCI in Irvine, California. You can go to nprnewsandnotes.org and find links to their blog.